I'm Marla Klayman. I'm at Northwestern University in the Feinberg School of Medicine in the Center for Communication and Healthcare, and I can already see that we're going to have some very interesting discussion points because I'm going to really talk about communication in the patient-provider relationship. That's my particular area of research. So where Dr. Frymuth was talking about too much focus on the individual, I actually am going to be focusing on the individual, but I won't hold it against you. But I think that there's some very interesting things to discuss and to think about. When I was getting ready for this talk, several people said to me, well, you're talking to a public health audience, so why would you talk about the patient-provider relationship? So although some of you may be more familiar with this than others, I'll let you know that there are over 900 million ambulatory physician office visits each year. And that includes many, many people who don't have insurance. So this also includes some of the uninsured, and I'm not going to get into access issues right now, but there are definitely issues there. I would also say that depending on what specialty and what area you're talking about, between a quarter and upwards of a half of those visits, there are family members present. So looking at people in context and looking at family and other social support can happen even within the patient-provider relationship. Lots of surveys in lots of different areas have shown that healthcare providers are the most trusted sources of health information. And interventions increasingly are implemented in the provider's office or with the imprimatur of the provider's office. These can include things like screening for cancer, immunizations, and decision aids around various topics. I really look at this as there have been in the past decade four really huge shifts in the way that communication is viewed, practiced, and researched. There's national recognition and funding for communication, which I think we've already talked a little bit about this morning. Professional education, use of new technologies and intervention research, and I'll say a little bit about each one of these. So first, a few years ago, Crossing the Quality Chasm, which is an Institute of Medicine report, came out, and it said in there, patient-centered care is fundamental to quality healthcare. So there's this idea that communication and healthcare quality are really intimately linked. Another quote from there says that patient-centered care is healthcare that establishes a partnership among practitioners, patients, and their families to ensure that decisions respect patients' wants, needs, and preferences, and solicit patients' input on the education and support they need to make decisions and participate in their own care. And this is very important when you start to look at this from whose responsibility is this for these patients' views to be known. Is it the provider's responsibility to elicit these viewpoints? Is it the patient's perspective where they need to be empowered in order to let their views be known? There's a lot of discussion and debate about the best ways to make this happen and the best ways for interventions to happen. And the report actually suggests specific communication measures of metrics of quality, and some of these are being implemented in ways to evaluate physicians, physician groups, and hospitals in terms of the quality of care that they give. Along these lines, ARC, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, had put out a call for developing interventions to inform decisions about effectiveness, which is called the DECIDE Network. They also use this around patient safety. The National Cancer Institute has a Health Communications and Informatics Research Branch, where some of you may be familiar with the HINT study, which is the Health Information National Trend Survey. They've also funded Centers of Excellence in Cancer Communication Research, and they have a monograph on patient-centered care. And the CDC has funded Centers of Excellence in Health Marketing and Health Communication. So at the national level, various agencies are really looking at communication in different ways and the way that communication can be integrated into healthcare systems. There have also been changes in professional training. I think this is really important because it's a formal recognition from the bodies that accredit these different healthcare providers that communication skills are an essential part of medicine. These include the Association of American Medical Colleges, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. Those are both those that accredit physicians, so MD programs and residency programs, as well as the American Association of Colleges of Nursing and the Accreditation Review Commission on Education for the Physician Assistant. There are others as well, including the pharmacy associations. So various healthcare professionals and paraprofessional organizations are looking at communication. As an example, the USMLE, which is what somebody must pass in order to be a board, in order to become a physician, tests communication competency. And they do this based on an interaction with a standardized patient, which is an actor who has been trained to act as a patient. What's really interesting and important about this is that it's scored by the standardized patient. So when they look at communication skills, they have people who are physicians looking at whether or not these new physicians are doing things technically accurately, but they are having the standardized patient score whether or not this new physician is adequately doing things like questioning skills, information sharing skills, and their professional manner and rapport. And this is a really fundamental shift. It used to be that physicians would, if somebody was a particularly good communicator and they were impressed by that, that hopefully that person would mentor them and that they would learn to communicate well. But this formalizes this, and I'm not saying that there are no problems with it, but it says to all medical schools, we expect your students, who will see thousands and thousands of patients over their careers, to have some competency in this area, and that it is on par with other competencies that we expect physicians to have. Getting to changes in practice, Tom already mentioned some of the new technologies. There's also been an expansion of the electronic medical record, although I would also state that approximately half of all primary care physicians' offices do not use an electronic medical record. So this is by no way something that happens everywhere. I think for people who are in academia, it's hard to remember that sometimes because the large physician practices and the academic practices have the electronic medical record. But it does change how providers interact with patients. We also have the use of the internet by patients, and that changes how patients interact with providers. The internet-based information may or may not be reliable, and it may or may not be known to providers. And there are many studies that have shown that providers talk about the internet as a double-edged sword. And yet, providers are very often, they're not very clear on how they best want to use the internet in their own practices. In terms of the way that research is conducted, it's really been phenomenal. We have people who are communicating via the internet and implementation of web surveys in terms of how they conduct their own research. For example, the HINT study, which I mentioned earlier in its last iteration, used both telephone surveys and web surveys. So people are trying to move beyond traditional ways of getting people to conduct research and to answer their research questions. We also have lower rates of people in telephone surveys because people have caller ID, and I don't know if any of you screen your calls, but people, when they see a phone number that they don't recognize, are less likely to engage in that research. In terms of the type of research that I do in with patient-provider, there's also the ability to video record encounters, and so there are many differences in terms of how we can analyze the physician-patient relationship. The last thing that I'll mention is intervention research. There's been a lot more emphasis on intervention than on description, and this goes along in parallel with what Tom was saying about wanting to evaluate things. There's also more movement toward intervening. There's also more emphasis on theory-based intervention research and use of a broader range of theories. I think that people have recognized that we've been somewhat deficient in theory, and people are looking to different theories for the ways to try to combat this. And there are also dual roles within the patient-provider relationship of various types of providers of persuasion and shared decision-making. So you're trying to get people to do something that has an evidence base, but at the same time, for things where there's not an evidence base, where there are two equally good options for people, that we want patients to engage in shared decision-making, which means that their preferences and values are really integral into the decision-making process. In summary, I would say that there have been these really huge shifts in how communication is viewed from both policy and research perspectives. I would probably add to that from a consumer or patient perspective as well. The public, I think, views communication differently. And new technologies have also changed this interaction between the people who are involved, but as well the ways to disseminate the messages and, from my perspective, also conducting the research. So not just the interpersonal aspects or the mass media aspects, but how we as researchers conduct that research as well. Thank you.